Now, I've got another book in my hand here, which is very relevant to 1968, 50 years ago. It says Northern Ireland's 68 Civil Rights Global Revolt and the Origins of the Troubles. Quite a bit about this on the TV as well over the last week or so. Some great programmes on UTV, I should emphasise. BBC have been covering it too. Generally, it's marking, just a central part in our history. I want to speak to the person behind this particular book, Simon Prince. Simon, good morning.
Good morning to you.
A senior lecturer in Canterbury Christchurch University School of Humanities, obviously someone who has an eye on history generally and certainly on civil rights around the world. Now, it's an interesting little press essay at the back of your book, Simon, that says the Troubles may have developed into a sectarian conflict, but the violence was sparked by a small band of leftists who wanted Derry in 1968 to be a repeat of Paris in May of the same year. We've been watching a lot of TV recently that suggests that the violence developed because the RUC beat people on the street with batons. So which is true?
Oh, that's a complicated question to start me off with. Okay, so essentially I would argue what Martin Luther King argued about civil rights marches and the response to them, which is, you know, you can't accuse somebody of being guilty for having money on them and then being robbed. So what was happening by the left-wing militants was confrontational, it was provocative, but that in no way morally excuses the reaction of the police.
So there was blame on both sides from get-go in relation to civil rights?
I'm a historian, so those sort of moral questions are more for kind of the general public or for politicians or for religious figures. So I'm just trying to kind of explain, interpret, and give a fact-based account of what happened.
So you describe how you see 1968 when you look back. Describe what you believed, you believe unfolded.
So Northern Ireland was in a period of quite dramatic change, but a lot of that change was social and economic. So Derry was being reformed, but it wasn't being reformed in a way that was giving the vote to everyone. It wasn't being reformed in a way that was ending the gerrymander. It wasn't in a way that was giving control of the council to the majority of the population. It was being reformed in that jobs were coming, houses were going to be built, transport links were going to be improved, landscaping was going to be done, you know, the city walls were going to be made more attractive. It was going to be described as the city in the playground. So that was what was going to happen. But, you know, people wanted more than that. People wanted a political change as well.
Do you as a historian understand the need for political change at the time, or is it overstated?
I don't think it's overstated. I mean, what you try and do as a historian as much as you can is include in the narrative a multiplicity of voices, a multiplicity of perspectives. You try and see things from a range of different views. So you see how people could justify a position or be angry about something. And then you try and step back and be a bit more objective, as much as that's possible to be, about what people wanted and what was achievable.
Do you think civil rights may have arrived earlier? Do you think the Catholics, who obviously were the most disadvantaged people in this part of the world at the time, do you think they would have got the rights that they were calling for quicker if the violence hadn't have been generated by those who were motivated by more than just civil rights?
Well, firstly, I mean, civil rights, the people who organised the civil rights marches and demonstrations prior to October 68 were very clear that this was largely about more than just Catholic rights. It was about working class rights as well. And there's a speech which talks about how Sandy Row children should be getting a better education as well. And the people who organized the 5th of October march are very clear that not all Catholics live in slums and not all Protestants are exploitative landlords. And there's many kind of small scale things that take place in Derry to do with getting better traffic safety, to do with getting better midwifery that have been successful. In terms of serious changes, I think it's difficult to have that happen without violence. And this is again a very difficult question, but if you go over to America and look what Martin Luther King said, you need to have a crisis. Token marches, he says, that end peacefully are not going to be enough. You need to have a crisis to bargain with. So the previous events, which hadn't really caused too much trouble, could be ignored by the authorities. But when you have those shocking scenes appearing on TV, being shown around the world, the authorities have to sit up and take notice. When the police are saying, we can't control dairy anymore, the authorities have to take notice. And when local shopkeepers are saying, you know, we're being boycotted, our bottom line is being hurt here, the authorities have to take notice. And after 49 days of the civil rights movement, you get more reform, more concessions coming from Stormont than you had in the previous 49 years.
The names of 1968 through to 69, the figures of history that you would write about in this book, which ones stick out for you?
I think the one which kind of really sticks out for me is Eddie McAteer, who sometimes gets overlooked or done down a bit. He was the MP for the area. He was the leader of the Nationalist Party, effectively, and he is torn between thinking we need to do something and between worrying. You know, he's a relatively old man by this point. He's seen lots of things happen, seen lots of things go wrong. He refers to repeating mistakes. And so I think he's quite a dry comic character. One of the British civil servants who talks to him says, you know, you can't summarize what he says. He talks in these wonderful paragraphs. And so I think he's a very appealing character, and it's always useful to kind of go back to what he was saying and think about his insights. And he's someone who gets overlooked. I imagine he's not been talked about very much. And on the 5th of October, 68, poor Eddie McAteer got kneed in the groin by a policeman and was very sheepish about talking about that particular injury, unlike Jerry Fitt, who got hit round the head and was keen for everyone to see the cut.
The man who's kneed in the groin on the video footage, is that McAteer in the famous footage, or is that a different person?
That's a different person, and you know, some historians, you know, I'm not going to commit myself here, but some historians think that he may have been pretending that he'd been hit, that he kind of, he knew the camera was on him, and this would be a good point to kind of be a bit of a star. But again, I know it's hard to tell. It's not conclusive, the footage.
Is there a possibility that you'd be more sympathetic to the RUC in this book than some other writers would be?
I wouldn't use the term sympathetic. I think it's important to be aware of the kind of complexity and the ambiguity of what happens in the past, not just in Northern Ireland at this time, but you know, the whole of history. Because if you're going to construct a strong, robust argument that can stand up to scrutiny, you have to be aware of that sort of thing. Because if you are offering a kind of simplistic interpretation, it can get easily knocked down. So as some people have argued, I've heard over the last couple of days, that the RUC, whenever there was an anti-unionist demonstration, immediately waded into them, then you can quite easily say, well, that just isn't the case, because the RUC let a protest take place in Armagh during Easter, didn't interfere with that. You can say that on the day itself, the march went off down Duke Street, which was illegal. The police stopped them in a harsh way. But then the police allowed an illegal meeting to take place. Not more than that. They gave the speakers a megaphone to use. They gave them some chairs to stand on and address the meeting. And for about an hour, the police don't do anything. And then at the end, Ivan Cooper has actually talked to the senior officers and said, look, if you let the marchers slip through the police lines without placards, and if they promise not to reform as a march, is that a solution to this? You've got all these people trapped. Can you just let them through if they're not going to continue as marches? And the police agree to that. So it's trying to sort of understand exactly why there is violence.
Ivan Cooper, you refer to an elderly man now and part of the commemorations, indeed, very recently, the chair of the Derry Citizens Action Committee at that point in time, and very much a friend of John Hume, who then was a community activist and vice chair of the Derry Citizens Action Committee. If you want to find out, if you want to get an understanding of Simon Prince's interpretation of people like Terence O'Neill or Sean McStayfoyne or Eamon McCann, Eddie McAteer, Sean Lamass, all those names from the past and many others as well, including Bernadette Devlin and Austin Curry, as I flick through and read yet another book on civil rights. If you want to get an understanding of where Simon Prince is coming from, Northern Ireland's 68, Civil Rights, Global Revolt, The Origins of the Troubles. You would argue it's a very balanced book, Simon. How long did it take you to write it?
Oh, it took me ages to write it. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that attracted me to studying Northern Ireland is that the archives are just fantastically full. People were aware at the time that something really big was happening and were collecting loads of information. So it's not just, you know, not just police records or court records or what was being said in the cabinet rooms. It's ordinary people putting together newsletters. It's people sending letters to themselves. It's full of information in the archives. So it took a very long time.
And finally, Simon, could people, the young people of today, learn anything from 68? We're at another crossroads here in this part of the world, the great Brexit crossroads and the re-establishing or not of the executive here. People are probably a little more worried than they would have been 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Could the young people, the young activists of today, those who know little about what 68 was like, could they learn from leafing through this?
I hope so. I mean, I always think about a line one of Martin Luther King's friends said about him, which he didn't want to be remembered as a saint, he didn't want to be seen as a saint, because that meant other people wouldn't feel they could do it. They would not be up to achieving the things that he achieved. So looking through this book, perhaps those names, I mean, you ran through some of those names, some of the activists, I mean, you could throw in Kevin Boyle as well there. They're icons now. And if you could see them when they were young and they were making mistakes and they were full of enthusiasm, maybe that can be an inspiration, because politics is something that should belong to everyone. Everyone should be engaged in it. They shouldn't just feel that this is something that is an elite game that is closed off to them.
Well, people make up their own mind, and if they do pick it up in a bookshop or they read it and they get back to us, they'd be very welcome indeed. It is published by Irish Academic Press, and it's called Northern Ireland's 68 by Simon Prince. Simon, good speaking to you. Thanks for coming on. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So there's a historian's perspective, and of course, the best advice on any topic is to read widely on it and form your own opinion. It's the best way to go. David Dunseith said that one time, and I couldn't agree more with him. And David Dunseith was the master of this craft.